Wintrust Business Lunchtime on WGN. Elise Glink normally joins us at this time. Hi, Elise. How are you?
I'm good, John. You?
I'm doing pretty good. Had a nice weekend. I hope you did, too.
I did.
You are frequently found at glink.substack.com or at thinkglink.com. And, of course, we all listen to you and Tom Fortino Sunday mornings on WGN Radio at 6:30 with This Week in Wealth. Steve Alexander last week pointed out that the average age of a new home buyer is, 36?
Yes.
But I think that you've got more numbers about this, like how long people plan on keeping homes.
Yeah, it's interesting. So the National Association of Realtors released its annual publication called Profile of Home Buyers and Sellers in America. Well-titled. But there were some extraordinary findings for anybody who follows real estate. And, you know, this is set aside the idea that we're now well over 7% for a 30-year fixed-rate loan, and we may actually get to 8.5% on a 30-year fixed-rate loan, at which point in time I think every realtor's head will explode. But when you think about who is buying and selling, there are some real differences, things that have never happened before. And I know you and I had this conversation after I got back from the National Association of Realtors meeting, and I said to you, there's this whole never before thing going on. But first time home buyers are only a quarter, about 26% of all buyers, and that is the lowest share since NAR has, the realtors have been tracking the data. That is a very, very small percentage and considered a real negative when you're building for the future of real estate. We also saw, like you said, the average typical first time buyer is now 36 years old. That's up from 33 years a year ago. So it's really taking a lot longer for people to get their down payments together and to be able to qualify. We also saw a new age for the typical repeat buyer. That's almost 60 years old, 59 plus, and that's up also 3 years from 56 years in 2021. And again, highest in history for both of those.
Typical repeat buyer. That means somebody buying their second or more house?
Correct. It's somebody who's, you know, finally moving out of the first house. Maybe they bought that first house when they were, I don't know, maybe they were 26 or maybe they were 33 when they bought it. And now they're changing. And what that speaks to, John, is how long people are actually staying in those houses. And so that is another number that is we've never seen before. Typically, people stayed in their homes for between 7 and 10 years. And back in 2006 and 2007, when people were really in the frenzy of flipping homes, that kind of fell down to the lower level of maybe 7 years. But today, people are spending an average of 18 years for as first-time buyers in their home. And that is the highest ever recorded, and it's up from 10 years last year.
That's not good or bad, is it? I mean, if you stay in a house for 20 years, you've got equity, you can borrow against it. There's a lot of good reasons to stay put, right?
There is, but a lot of people are staying put. And the reason they're staying put and will stay put for a long time now is that they've got interest rates under 3%. So you and
I have talked about this, right?
So why would you give up an interest rate of 2.5, 3, 3.5, even 4% if you have to trade it for a home that's much more expensive and interest rates are now maybe 7, 7.5%? So the cost differential between staying where you are and maybe renovating your house or selling and moving somewhere new is so great that I know that there are some real estate economists who are quite concerned that people simply won't sell. And if they don't sell, there's not as much for agents and buyers to work with.
Yeah, well, it affects inventory too, I suppose, in a way, although everybody that moves has got to move somewhere else. But I wonder if the absence in this case has something to do with the lack of adjustable rate mortgages in the last few years, too. A lot of time, my first mortgage was an ARM, and you know, if it was going to adjust and we were still in that house to a rate we didn't like, we would have sold it before we would have stayed put, right?
Correct. Most people now, especially since the Great Recession, have fixed rate loans. They adjustable rate mortgages literally fell out of favor,
sure.
Especially when you had interest rates down under 3%. There was no point in taking on the extra risk of an adjustable rate mortgage, or an ARM as you called it, when you could get a fixed rate loan that cheaply. And so more people were steered into those fixed rate loans, you know, appropriately so, whether they were 15 years or 30 years. We also saw a huge number of people who went into 10-year mortgages.
Yeah.
And those are going to be coming, you know, they're going to pay those off in the next, you know, 3 to 4 years, if not even sooner. And then they're not going to have any reason to move because they'll have paid off those loans. And
right.
So there's concern.
Stay right there. Elise Glink's on the line. You can always read her stuff at thinkglink.com. Elise, you were talking to us about some of the real estate trends. Before we go on to a couple of other topics, is there anything else in that report you want to make sure we're aware of?
You know, I just, one of the things that was sort of interesting is that people were definitely moving farther away over the last, we saw this begin at the pandemic. People were, I'm out of the city, I'm moving away. And typically the home that people move to was 50 miles away. And that is a threefold jump from the 15 miles median from 2018 to 2021. So people really wanted to get out of town, John.
Do that again. The average amount that people moved was 50 miles?
Yeah. Yeah. The house, the median distance between the home that buyers purchased and the home they moved from was 50 miles. It was a record high.
Yeah. So that is what? You said people really wanted to get out of town. I suppose if you were living in the city, you wanted to get way out into the burbs, huh?
That's right. And what people were doing and what they have been doing is moving to rural communities or moving states. So there are a lot of, obviously, it's median, right? So a lot of people stayed around town where they were. But enough people are moving pretty far away that it moved the needle quite a bit. And that's something to watch going forward as we see where people are going to be going, you know, over the next couple of years. There is a survey that came out today that said that 90% or 95% of people who did move over the pandemic are unhappy with their choices and may move back. So we may see that number just continue to be a little strange over the next few years.
Yeah, I'm going to guess that's an anomaly, because if you move 50 miles, that means you're not driving back into wherever you used to drive back into. So that's a work from home number. And as we go back to more traditional work arrangements, I'll bet that needle's going to go the other way.
It could be. We also saw just a record number of people purchasing homes for 100% of the list price. 28% of people bought for more than list price last year, and that was just really an astonishing number also.
Wow. 28% paid over ask. 28%.
Yes. Crazy.
Well, okay. Let's talk a little bit about things in the economy and what interest rates are doing. So do you see the rates leveling off? Is it going to be more attractive to buy a house in the near future?
Well, this is really going to be what happens with the Fed. So the Fed, obviously, as we all know, raised the federal funds rate another 0.75%, 75 basis points. But what's not happening, John, is we're not seeing the inflation numbers come down enough yet. And so they said, nope, we're going to keep going. Maybe not at that level. Maybe they'll raise it a half a point. But what the housing economists were saying is that getting past 7% was one of those price levels. We talk about them in the stock market. If it falls below X place, it's likely to fall even further. Well, on the way up, you know, we've passed 7% now. The next kind of price ceiling is about 8.5%. And nobody's hoping that it gets there. That is a rate we haven't seen in a very, very long time.
Well, I haven't heard that put that way. So if it's to 7%, maybe somebody's still going to buy a house. But the next group of people who will decide not to buy a house as a result of these inflated rates would be at 8.5%.
That's right. Or they would just not be able to afford it. Because what it used to be, and I haven't checked this number in a while, and I can certainly do that for the next time we talk, but it used to be that for every a half a point that the interest rate went up on a 30-year fixed rate loan, like a million people could no longer afford to buy a house. Huh. There was some relationship between how high interest rates would go and who would fall off of the affordability. Now, given that average salaries have also gone up quite significantly over the last year or so, I'm not sure that particular ratio holds off. And I would like to point out, for those who are saying, well, we're headed for a cliff with regard to housing, we are still 5 million housing units short in this country. So there's still such a demand that even when interest rates go up, there are people who can afford to buy. It's just not people who are at maybe, you know, what we would call the lower level of income, you know, bottom half of an income spectrum. So it's concerning because you want everybody to have the ability to buy a house mm-hmm. and build wealth. Not everybody does right now.
Well, I've long said we've got less than a minute left here, Amy. I'm thinking of
Amy Kite.
Yeah, no kidding. Because I think she was talking about this on Hochberg's show the other day. But I'd still like to see more affordable homes being built. You know, are people putting up $250,000 homes new with amenities or not? And I don't know what's happening out there.
Well, what I can tell you is that the builders are really pulling back. And mostly they've been building more expensive homes because they just make more money at it. There's so many regulations now that just buying land is expensive, meeting the regulations is expensive. And so it's becoming increasingly hard to build the $150,000 to $250,000 homes. And so builders just aren't doing it.
Well, I don't blame them either. I mean, they're not the bad guy in this, but that doesn't make it any easier for the person who's trying to start a home buying life. Elise Glink is the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. She's the host of This Week in Wealth with Tom Fortino. That's on WGN Radio, Sunday mornings at 6:30. And you can check out Elise's wisdom at thinkglink.com. Okay, Elise, next Monday, let's do it again.
You bet, John.
On the Wintrust Business Lunch, Jim Dahlke joins us now, senior editor at ChicagoInno.com, a regular Monday guest for us. Let's talk about how Illinois schools are stacking up against other schools in terms of entrepreneurship. What do you know about this, Jim?
Hey, John. Yeah. So, you know, PitchBook, which is a venture capital data firm that really crunches the numbers on all things venture capital and startups, they came out with their annual list of the best universities for startup founders. Essentially, what the list did was take a look at all the grads from all these universities really across the world and looked at the founders that raised venture funding and how many founders were able to raise capital and how much capital they were able to raise. And so we got no Chicago schools cracked the top 20 in terms of undergrad universities. The University of Illinois came in at number 14 on the list, so really leading the way there statewide for undergrad. It's a bit of a different picture, though, when it comes to graduate schools. You get Northwestern pops into the top 10 at number 9, and University of Chicago right behind it there at number 11. And that's really not surprising. We've been very closely following the graduate programs at both of those schools. They have a lot of momentum there in terms of their founders who participate in those programs, and there's some very, very highly sought-after venture competitions that have produced a bunch of companies like Grubhub and Foxtrot and Tovala and some well-known Chicago companies that we've talked about here on this program. So interesting to see some of the familiar names really lead the way. Stanford, Harvard, MIT kind of pretty consistently cracking the top three for undergrad and graduate school. So a little room for Chicago's schools to make some ground up there, but in a not too bad of a showing.
To be clear, then, you just answered, I think, the question I was going to ask. What are we talking about here? And this would be somebody who graduates from Northwestern or University of Illinois at Urbana, and they go on to work for, or are you saying found a company like Tovala?
Yeah, these are folks that start a business and then raise capital. So we're looking at startup founders here. And so, yeah, I mean, it's something that Chicago still needs to improve upon. I mean, one thing that is improving, right, is that the folks that are starting businesses down at Illinois, they're no longer necessarily leaving for the coast, right? We're seeing much more opportunity here in Chicago to found a startup, to get invested and to build a tech business in Chicago where, hey, you know, maybe that wasn't exactly the case 15, 20 years ago. And so I think that's one thing that Chicago needs to continue to improve on is, hey, tapping into all that talent that's happening down at the University of Illinois and making sure they work their way back up to Chicago rather than fleeing for the coast. And so that's not only on the founder side, but also on the technical side. University of Illinois is one of the major producers of computer engineers in the country. And so keeping those folks here in Illinois and in Chicago specifically is something that the city is really making sure that they do better.
You can almost count Urbana as a Chicago school. I mean, those kids, so many of them are from the Chicago area, right?
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, one thing that COVID did was boomerang folks back a little bit. I think what we saw is, you know, people who left for the Valley, for LA, for New York, kind of came back home to some degree. And that's something that, you know, Chicago is going to hopefully, you know, see more of as the city's tech ecosystem continues to grow.
Your colleague Alex Zorn then wrote, Stanford's the number one school in America for producing these kinds of entrepreneurs, followed by the University of California at Berkeley, then Harvard, then MIT. Northwestern, as you said, the top-ranked Chicago area school at 23rd on the list. University of Chicago, 65. Stanford led the undergraduate list with a founder count of 1,427 different businesses started by grads from Stanford. Wow.
Yeah, and it really where they stand out is in capital raise. So Stanford comes in number one in undergrads, raising about $74 billion over the last 10 years. That's almost $30 billion above second place, California, Berkeley. So really, Stanford kind of showing that it is head and shoulders above the rest when it comes to universities for startup founders.
E. Malix, is that, am I saying that right? Here's another story from your Alex Zorn. What's this about?
Yeah, Emalex Biosciences. This is a biotech company here in Chicago creating drugs for patients that are battling Tourette syndrome. Big fundraise for them last week. So this is a business that raised $250 million. Big fundraising round as they head to phase three for their clinical trials for their Tourette syndrome drug. This is a big deal for Chicago. As a city, it falls a bit behind some other markets across the U.S. in terms of momentum for biotech, certainly behind cities like Boston, even other cities like Philadelphia. So this is a nice little win for Chicago as this company continues to grow. They've got some big name backers behind them as well. Valor Equity is behind them. That's the venture fund that's also backed Tesla and SpaceX, based here in Chicago, and Bain, their life sciences fund invested in them also. So we'll see kind of as where this company continues to grow. But hey, $250 million is a big vote of confidence, and really shows that Emalex has got some room to grow here.
Yeah. Do you know much about the efficacy or promise of this Tourette's drug?
You know what? So they're in their phase three for their clinical trials right now, and it's expected to enroll about 220 patients across 90 different sites. And what they say is this is the largest trial ever conducted in North America for their central nervous system disorder. So, the company really believes it's onto something, and they've got a big trial here to kind of prove that they've got really the drug that can help folks here.
Emalex, E-M-A-L-E-X, Biosciences is the company for those of you that want to do some more research on your own. And finally, Project 44, catch me up on this.
Yes, speaking of big funding rounds, Project 44 just last week announced it's raised $80 million. This is a logistics tech startup here in Chicago. Helps companies kind of with their different shipping technologies and communicating with the supply chain. Their customers include folks like Amazon and P&G and Unilever. And their new funding values the business at actually $2.7 billion. That's up from $2.4 billion when they raised funding earlier in the year. And that's noteworthy because a lot of companies that are raising right now aren't exactly raising at what we call up rounds, which is their valuation increases. Lots of companies, especially in difficult fundraising markets, have to raise at down rounds or valuations that are below what they previously raised. So certainly noteworthy for Project 44. And hey, Chicago says we're a logistics town. We're a logistics tech town. And Project 44 is certainly one of the biggest logistics tech startups in Chicago.
In a minute, we're going to talk with Adam Roth, who is in the business of logistics. So I'd be interested to see what he's saying about that, too. That's our next conversation. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, John.
Jim Dahlke with the Chicago Inno. He's a senior editor at ChicagoInno.com. We've got more business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago-based VillageMD, which operates primary care clinics in Walgreens stores, is buying Summit Health City MD for nearly $9 billion. The move will help VillageMD expand its footprint and offer specialty and urgent care services. Summit provides both of those services in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, and Oregon. VillageMD is a unit of Walgreens Boots Alliance. Walgreens says it's investing $3.5 billion in the deal. A Cigna subsidiary is also part of the deal. United Airlines is among the big companies suspending advertising with Twitter following the takeover of the company by Elon Musk. The Chicago-based carrier joins Pfizer, General Mills, and Volkswagen in pausing advertising on the social media site. Several large advertising agencies have also paused spending on Twitter. The companies are concerned about brand safety on Twitter because of toxic content. Musk himself tweeted a link to an unfounded conspiracy theory shortly after the deal closed, but later deleted the post. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Time for the business of food. Here's Steve Alexander.
Thank you, and I'll tell you how you can show a farmer some love right after I tell you we're sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience live in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. To Farmers with Love. That's the name of a contest you can get involved in, and it is not a romance kind of thing. That's a website called farmersonly.com. This is a promotion from the restaurant chain Culver's to show its love for farmers by giving them cash.
This is a new idea that we launched to be able to support farmers, and we know that harvest season is a busy time for them, so they can use a little extra love during this time.
Allison Emmer is a marketing and PR manager at Culver's. The fast food chain has long supported farmers and agriculture education with its Thank You Farmers project. And if you want to show your love to a farmer, you can go online and nominate him or her.
They can go to culvers.com/2farmerswithlove, and nominations will run through November 15th.
It's open to any kind of farmer, corn, beans, wheat farmers,
potato farmers, tomato farmers, chicken farmers,
all farmers anywhere in the United States.
We know that Culver's wouldn't be what it is today without our delicious food that we serve each and every day in our restaurants, from our butter burgers to our fresh frozen custard. And we've wanted to celebrate the people who make that possible from the start.
The top 15 vote getters will get $500 cash for themselves, Culver's gift cards and swag, and a $575 donation will be made to their local FFA chapter in their name. And I don't want this to sound like a commercial for Culver's, but I want to give credit where it's due. And since it started its Thank You Farmers project in 2013, it has donated over $3.5 million to agriculture education. So before Luke Bryan plays us out, you can nominate a farmer until next Tuesday at culvers.com/2farmerswithlove.
Here's to the farmer that plants the fields in the spring, the turn from green to bad harvest honey.
That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
We're talking a little bit about supply chain and about how the stores are and are not going to be stocked. Let's talk a little bit about that with Adam Roth, Executive Vice President of Industrial Services at NAI Hifman. He's the Director of NAI Global Logistics. Hey, Adam, thanks for joining us today.
John, thanks for having me.
So logistics, you're an expert in, do you track or do you actually do logistics?
I do logistics. I'm actually an industrial real estate broker, believe it or not, but some people like to say I'm a disguised as that. I'm actually a logistics person at heart.
And so what do you do then? What does that first thing mean?
It means I sell, lease industrial real estate, so distribution space, manufacturing space, warehousing space.
Hmm. And does that tell us something about either the retail sector or maybe how the coming holiday season is going to do?
Yeah, absolutely. I work very closely with a lot of retailers and a lot of distributing companies, so I hear firsthand what their concerns are and how they're dealing with essentially the bullwhip effect that's been occurring in the supply chain.
Yeah.
Very close to the supply chain.
Well, what do you hear? Are the stores sufficiently stocked, or are the warehouses going to have the inventory people want? I hear folks still want to buy this Christmas.
They do, and the projection of spending is definitely up. We have three kids, and it's a great time to be a holiday shopper this year. Very different than the last 2 years.
Why? How so?
Well, they're saying that inventories are up over 24% since last summer, and as part of the bullwhip effect, and corporations trying to adjust their inventories, they didn't want to miss out like they did the last 2 years and not have stuff on the shelves. So they classic overreaction, and they ordered the inventory, and it got in on time this year, and now it's in abundance. So there's going to be additional sales going on. You already had a Prime Day sale that occurred two times the first day. You had a show on that about a month ago. That's the first time they did two in a year.
Right.
Walmart's now doing a sale every Monday. They're dropping a different type of sale going. Target's getting involved. Essentially, I'm waiting for the next big sale. So you have Black Friday, Cyber Monday. You know, someone's going to come out with Blue Tuesday here any day.
Yeah, I was just going to say something or another Wednesday. It doesn't even matter.
Day of the week.
So that sounds good for consumers. Does that necessarily hurt retailers or the economy? Is it net positive, negative, or neutral?
It's very tough on the retailers. So they're saying that in particular computers, electronics, toys, you're going to see discounts probably over 20%. They're concerned about getting and pushing the inventory out because it gets worse if they have to hold on to the inventory beyond the season.
Does this also mean then that the lines of transportation from the ships off the coast in L.A. to a store in Chicago, those are all pretty clear now? Things are moving?
Not yet, but it's definitely we're on the tail end of the issues in the supply chain. That the projection of clearing that is really near the end of first quarter of 23 to return to some kind of normalcy. But there's been some tailwind effects of that. So the historical just-in-time inventory, the new term is instead of just-in-time, it's just-in-case. So corporations keeping more product on hand and making a more resilient supply chain. And there's going to be some other after effects long term that I forecast in what we're just coming out of.
Like what?
Well, I think as we continue to decouple from China and as there continue to be growing geopolitical concerns and the challenges and the variables that have occurred in the elongated supply chain, it's forcing companies to really shorten their length of haul, to shorten their supply chain. So you're going to hear new terms in 2023 and beyond. Instead of supply chain, you're going to hear supply web, where you have more variables and ways to respond. International regionalization is a different way of phrasing that. Multi-shoring, near-shoring, reshoring is all very, very real. It used to be more just anecdotal, and now about every boardroom I go into, they're looking at ways to make their production, if possible, parts of it in North America. Now, it's been a 20-year migration to China. It'll take a while to turn that aircraft carrier, so to speak, but it is absolutely happening.
Is that going to mean higher prices? It seems like that's why we went to Vietnam and China and South Korea, et cetera.
I think risk is assessed differently now by corporations.
Yeah,
and I think they're looking at it, and it's not the same. As an example, during the peak of the pandemic, container rates went up to $40,000 a container. They're already back down to under $4,000.
Huh.
So just it's such an extreme bullwhip, and I understand the overreaction. It's created a very interesting holiday season. In addition, when you look at returns, it's so tight. Think of it. If you're a retailer, John, and you're trying to burn through your inventory so it doesn't carry over, and then you have returns coming back. Yeah, that's very difficult to swallow.
Yeah.
Last year, they projected about 17% of merchandise was returned, which is worth about $760 billion. So to try to prevent that, some of the retailers are shortening their return timeframes, and they're also starting to charge customers for restocking fees.
We've run into that already. My wife and I bought a couple things and went to take it back, and they said 30 days are up. This was on the 31st day, and we're like, oh, shoot. So perhaps that's the future. We're out of time, Adam, but this is really interesting stuff. I hope you can join us again.
No, I really appreciate the time. Thank
Adam
you.
Roth, you bet. Executive Vice President of Industrial Services at NAI Hifman. Hifman.com is their website.